Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. Hang on one second. I'm just going to do a sound check here. Such a riot. Hold on one second. I'm just going to see if I can...
So much for live radio. We give us folks having trouble with live radio.
Citizens recruited by Al-Qaeda. They're looking in our backyard. They're here already. And if an American citizen joins Al-Qaeda, they do so at their own peril. They will go to court. They'll have a hearing about whether or not you're a member of the organization. But we're at war. We have one person that orders our troops into battle. That same person has the authority to determine who the enemy is because we're at war. Thank you.
You said about the Nazis, but also at that
time. They got tried with the Nuremberg trial, and they used the same excuse that we're at war, and we can do whatever we like.
Well, see, that's the point I'm trying to make. If someone were ordered to kill an innocent American where there's no evidence that they have committed, you know, they're involved in terrorism.
Is the disposition matrix
please,
enough?
Please. Person carrying out the order could be prosecuted. In the military, you don't have the Nuremberg defense that I'm carrying out orders. So really, the men and women who pull the trigger on drones and who drop bombs, I know them. I know the pains they go through to prevent collateral damage. We're not the SS. We're a very ethical military. The thought that goes into targeting people is incredible. I know the program. I know the checks and balances. But the difference, I guess, I have with some is that I believe we're at war, and when you're at war, the commander-in-chief makes those decisions. He makes the decisions who to send in the battle, and he makes the decisions of who we're fighting. And I just believe that's the way we have to do it.
Yeah, one person.
Thank you.
One Al-Qaeda operative having dinner at the Pentagon after 9/11. It was reported by Fox News and CBS. Are you going to look into this, Al-Awlaki?
The thing that surprised me so much on that video was it's just like he doesn't get it, what he's saying. He doesn't realize what he's saying, or does he? He said that only one person is in charge of determining who our enemies are.
Yeah.
What the hell is that? Obama can determine who my enemy is?
I guess
or so. Our enemies
as
are?
As a country, yeah.
Yeah, I mean... You know, and the Congress has nothing to do with that?
To give the president such sweeping powers,
I think, is very dangerous. That's totally dictatorial. That's totally unconstitutional.
Well, we don't need the Congress.
But that's what they were saying about the matrix here, the thing that they were, that they authorized giving him, total control over.
So why do we need the Congress?
Well, war. I mean, basically, the right to declare war on anybody or kill anybody. You know?
So why do we need the Congress?
Exactly.
Why don't they just send them all home?
They're nothing but obstructionists,
mm-hmm.
except in the case where they gave him full control of the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
huge executive powers. That is so dangerous.
It's amazing. I mean, it's just
what's
incredible.
The difference between him and a dictator?
None. There is none. And that's why we don't understand this. I mean, why would the Lindsey Graham, a Republican, okay, be so eager to give Obama sweeping military powers? And he never had.
Good question.
I mean, he can't. You know, Congress declares war. The president
not
doesn't
anymore.
Declare war. Now the president can declare war on anybody he wants. You know,
including you or anybody else.
Including you, right? Even if he says, "Oh, hey, I don't like that article you wrote. I think you're a terrorist. You're dead." Okay, boom. There goes a drone over my head. You know what I mean?
Whoops, sorry if it kills your neighbor and your dog and your cat.
Collateral damage, we need you and Lila. That's the key, you know, to get the two of you, you know. So,
anyway, let's move on.
I mean, that's what they're saying.
Let's move on.
That's ridiculous. They're totally sick.
Thank you, we are changed.
They're such an ethical military, right?
Yeah.
We're so ethical. Jeez. Yeah. Okay. Ooh. I don't know if you heard this on the news today or not, but
the Italians have to give up their money too.
The Italians going to be, I mean, the deposits, okay, are going to be.
Well, do you think that's a tax that's coming here?
Well, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because these guys, what they're going after here is the illegal money,
mm-hmm.
okay, the Russian money,
mm-hmm.
all right, and the illegal money in these tax write-off
mm-hmm.
areas. So. And Germany just says that they expect that they, you know, either you do this or you're out of the EU, you know, and they want to.
I'd say yay out of the EU.
Yeah, that's what I would say too, but for some reason not. But it turns out that the banking chief calls for 15% of looting of Italian savings. That's kind of strange, so strange. But they want 15%. of the Italian savings, and then on Cyprus there in Greece they want the same thing.
Okay, let's see what this is.
Yeah, it's been a lot. I just want to make sure.
It's by Paul Watson, I think.
Yeah.
It's from PrisonPlanet.com. Now that the International Monetary Fund initially demanded to loot a shocking 40% of savings from the private bank accounts of Cyprus, underscores how residents of the Mediterranean country could be the latest victims of infamous IMF riot. As the chief economist of the German Commissar Bank calls for Italians to be similarly plundered for 15% of their savings, the government of Cyprus is set to vote tomorrow on enforcing a tax, which in reality is nothing less than a confiscation of private wealth that would hit savers with between 100,000 to 500,000 euros with a levy of a 9.9% tax. Those with over half a million euros will face an even higher rate of 15%. However, the scale of the robbery could have been far higher. As Zero Hedge reports, it appears that the settled upon 9.9% haircut is a good deal compared to the stunning 40% of total deposits that Germans Finmin Schausabel and the IMF demanded. Now that the dictatorial EU and the IMF have simply set up about stealing the privately accrued wealth of lifetime savers in Europe, everyone is asking one question: who's next? George Kramer, chief economist of the German Commissar Bank, has called for private savings accounts in Italy to be similarly plundered. A tax rate of 15% on financial assets would probably be enough to push the Italian government debt below the critical level of 100% of gross domestic product, he told Handelsblatt. Although many Cypriots reacted with anger over the theft of their savings, with one man threatening to drive a bulldozer into his local bank, the reaction has been so far notably calmer than one would expect in a country like Italy, which has already been hit with violent anti-austerity riots over the past year. Excuse me.
Are we now seeing yet another example of the IMF riot, where the banking elite deliberately fosters social dislocation as a ruse to seize control of nations' economies and begin the process of asset stripping, just as has happened in Greece and Argentina? Are Cyprus and Italy now in the crosshairs? As respected investigative reporter Greg Palast exposed in 2001, the global banking elite, namely the World Bank and the IMF, have honed a technique that has allowed them to asset strip numerous other countries in the past, and the technique has come down to be known as the IMF riot.
In April of 2001, Flaft obtained leaked World Bank documents that outlined a four-step process on how to loot nations of their wealth and infrastructure, placing control of resources into the hands of the banking elite. One of the final steps of the process, the IMF riot, detailed how the elite would plan for a mass civil unrest ahead of time that would have the effect of scaring off investors and causing government bankruptcies. This economic arson has its bright side for foreigners, who can then pick off remaining assets at fire sale prices, writes Palast, adding, a pattern emerges. There are lots of losers, but the clear winner seems to be the Western banks and the U.S. Treasury. How long before this crisis engendered by looting forces Cyprus to sell its precious assets in return for IMF debt, just as Greece has been doing over the last 3 years? The looting of Cyprus, erroneously labeled a tax, has been spun by the Cypriot government, the IMF, and the EU, and the establishment financial media as a necessary evil to prevent the country's banks going bust and the nation collapsing into bankruptcy. First, as Mark J. Grant explains, describing the mover as a tax is an insult to reality. Let's be quite clear. The European Union has confiscated the private property of its citizens in Cyprus without debate, legislation, or parliamentary agreement, he writes. A bank account is not a bond or stock or any sort of investment. This seems to be lost on many people. A bank account is the private property of a citizen or corporation and does not belong to the government, or at least that was the supposition up until now in Europe. Secondly, the doomsday proclamation about Cyprus collapsing if the government is not allowed to loot private bank accounts is merely a cover story to justify what represents a brazen act of mass financial rape. Instead of protecting the bankers responsible for the crisis while pillaging the people who bear no responsibility whatsoever for the debt, Cyprus should be following in the footsteps of Iceland. Instead of bailing out bankers, Iceland arrested them. Instead of targeting its population with brutal austerity measures, Iceland paid off people's underwater mortgages. Iceland also allowed people to pay off debts in foreign currency, which were declared illegal with the devaluated krona. The result was that Icelanders had more money in their pocket, reinvested it into the economy, and now the country has enjoyed a miracle financial turnaround. The Cypriot government has seemingly chosen a different option: sell out its people to the gaping jaws of the European Union and the IMF, and setting the stage for years of economic turmoil, civil unrest, and the dependency on a financial dictatorship which benefits not from stability but from sustained chaos. And that was by Paul Joseph Watson, and he's the editor and writer for InfoWars and Planet.
So that's kind of where they stand right now, and that's crazy. But this one was even more frightening, because if you think that's happening there, in Argentina makes grabs for pensions amid crisis.
Mm.
Yeah, that's kind of even more scary, because they're going after the public pensions.
Mm-hmm. Not people's 403Ks?
They don't have that in Argentina, I guess. They're going more for the pensions. Buenos Aires, hemmed in by the global financial squeeze and commodity slump, Argentina, leftist government has seemingly found a novel way to find the money to stay afloat, cracking open the piggy bank of the nation's private pension system.
Mm-hmm.
Argentina's president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, that's kind of a German whatever, she's the Argentina president, right, that the new pope doesn't like, speaks next to the economy minister Carlos Fernandez of the national, I wonder if she's related. She's Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and he's Carlos Fernandez at the national.
Probably the same family, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. And the government proposed to nationalize the private pensions, which would provide it with much of the cash it needs to meet debt payments and avoid second default this decade. The move came as wealthy nations unveiled fresh steps to fight the credit crunch. And the U.S. Federal Reserve said it would bolster money market funds, which have faced withdrawals, but by lending as much as $540 billion to the industry. Okay, France said it would inject $14 billion into six banks on condition they agreed to increase their lending. And assigned banks were a little more willing to lend to each other. The London Interbank offered the rate, a benchmark for many businesses, and consumer loans again declined.
Argentine President Cristina Kirchner said the move to take over the private pension system was aimed at protecting investors from losses resulting from global market turmoil. Funds in the system, which is parallel to a government pension system, are administered by financial firms. The private system has about $30 billion in assets and generates about $5 billion in new contributions each year. While no one knows for sure what the government would do with the private system, economists and nationalization would let the government raid new pension contributions to cover short-term debts due in coming years. Argentina's financing needs are growing quickly as the global financial squeeze pushes down prices of its commodity exports, such as soybeans. Coupled with unchecked government spending, the commodity downturn has carved a gap of around $10 billion to $11 billion in what Argentina must pay on its debts between now and the end of 2009, according to economists. The payments are from debts restructured after the 2001 default and new debt issued locally.
Well, wait just a second. I'm curious there. No, this thing was posted on March 18th. Oh, I see. This was posted on this blog on March 13th.
March 18th,
but it was actually published in the Wall Street Journal on October 22nd, 2008.
And it was written by Matt Moffat.
Right. So, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but they've already tapped into the pension funds in Argentina.
And I wonder what happened as a result of that.
We don't know.
What was the outcome?
It doesn't say. Because it hasn't happened yet. According to that, it happened, but they, you know, there's not an update.
Yeah, so, we don't know what happened as a result.
Folks, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know. I'm sorry I went to that one. I didn't realize it was repost. Yeah.
Commendation without investigation.
Condemnation,
Without investigation is the height of ignorance. That's according to Albert Einstein. I think he's right.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Right.
Trouble is that nobody investigates correctly today.
Well, we condemn based on investigation. I don't know.
This is interesting. Britain opposes the EU pesticide ban on neonicotinoid pesticides blamed for bee deaths around the world.
And extraordinary steps were taken by the British government last night to head off a proposed EU ban on neonicotinoid pesticides. Okay. Do you want to read?
Which have been widely blamed for bee deaths around the world. The Environment Secretary Owen Paterson circulated a note to all 27 EU members states saying that there was not enough evidence yet for a ban, which environmental campaigners have increasingly called for and is already supported by 13 EU countries. Excuse me. In a Brussels vote on the ban last Friday, in which the UK government abstained, the necessary majority could not be reached and the issue remained deadlocked. The British abstention was widely criticized.
So it means that, you know,
they're probably producing the pesticides.
Yeah, or, you know, it's Roundup or something. You know, it's the
Monsanto.
I'm going to bring up the rest of this article, folks, but it's so slow. There we go. It's coming. It's almost here. Yes. No, no, if you didn't. Okay.
It's from the Independent.
persuading other member states that the evidence is not there. although 30 scientific papers have linked the substance with harm to bees in the last 3 years.
The UK,
what more do they need for crying out?
The UK note to all EU agricultural ministers challenges Brussels to present scientific proof based in a real world, not theoretical studies, that pesticide poisoning is to blame. It says all pesticide use should be controlled so as to prevent unacceptable effects on non-target species and the environment, as well as preventing harmful effects on human health.
So they're trying to get rid of this stuff. We're working on it, folks. So hard. It's so hard to go up against these goddamn killer corporations. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the New World Order. All right, well, we talked about it enough times on our show, but according to this article, the New World Order is now shifting into ramming speed with the new pope. All right, so let's read about this. Lila, what do you think?
Yeah, let's go right to the article.
Yeah, I think it's funny.
Let's see.
I changed my mind. I don't like the author on this.
Oh, that's the one that
I
wasn't author. Impressed with that.
No. Nope. You want to do this chemtrail one?
Yeah. So
it's good to bring that up.
We have to remind people about chemtrails again. So you don't believe in chemtrails? This is Hanging Garden of Babylon.
Yeah.
Website. Oh, some great pictures.
Yeah.
And this is by Vincent Anderson in 2013. That's fine, neither do most people who don't have to live under them, but chemtrails are not just something you believe in, like some believe that there will be 75 nubile virgins waiting for them in heaven if they just kill a few infidels. There's no documentary evidence for that, but there is documentary evidence for the existence of chemtrails, which is overwhelming and inescapably conclusive. And so here's just a taste for some of it. The chemtrail program that we see today began in earnest in the 90s. However, the technology has existed for a lot longer, and there are other incidents of its use before the 90s. One notable example was in Britain from the late 50s to the late 70s, when large parts of the country were sprayed with chemicals for germ warfare experiments. This information was locked away in government archives and has only been released recently to the public, as 50 years have now passed. Many people have had children with birth defects because of this government-sponsored aerosol spraying campaign. You can read this on the Guardian newspaper report. The U.S. government has also deployed similar technology during the Vietnam War. They used cloud seeding technology to prolong the monsoon season to disrupt the Vietnamese supply lines. It was called Operation Popeye and was considered successful. More recently, the Chinese government publicly used cloud-busting technology during the Olympics to ensure that the skies remained clear. I cite these examples of evidence of weather manipulation technology that has been in use for many years. Although the chemtrail program is slightly different, it is based upon the same technology that we know has been deployed historically. In the 1990s, people began to notice that contrails normally emitted by aircraft were lingering in the sky, forming cloud cover and blocking out the sun. Some of these people could see that they were being sprayed with some substance. So in order to understand what it was, they had their rainwater and soil independently tested. These tests consistently found exceedingly high levels of aluminum, barium, and strontium in the areas affected by the spraying. These tests have now been carried out in many countries around the world with the same results. Some of the countries in which tests have been done include the USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, France, Germany, Spain, and many others. From these tests, people have become aware that they are being sprayed, but this gives rise to more questions than it answers. How are they doing this, and who is doing it? To try and answer the how, we look at the list of patents that are related to this sort of technology. From doing so, we can conclude that it is highly possible. You can view an exhaustive list of easily verifiable patents if you go to this website and you can click on there. in this article. These patents describe various ways of carrying out spraying, from mixing it in jet fuel through to the dedicated spray nozzles with specially designed feeder tanks. They mix it up. From the patent record, we can also see that this technology has been around since World War II. It is also evident that some of the very sophisticated technologies have been developed over the years, so much so that it is now possible to adapt nearly all types of jet aircraft to use this.
People investigating have been monitoring aircraft to try and identify those that are carrying out the spraying. But using flight radar and other computer applications that identify commercial aircraft, investigators are able to determine if the aircraft passing overhead is civilian or not. With these types of applications, you are able to see the flight number, airline operator, and other flight details. This has enabled investigators to identify many airlines that are involved in the spraying. Sadly, there are a lot of them. And also, by using modern cameras with high-speed, high-powered lenses, many excellent videos and photos exist that have been used to help identify those aircraft that are spraying. Military tanker planes are often observed spraying in NATO-affiliated countries. This is a small selection of existing videos and photos. They have a great display of photos
here. Oh, the photos are amazing.
But they're real. We see them ourselves all the time around here. I don't know if I've ever seen that one.
Mm-mm.
Or that one either, but
I've seen crosses in the sky.
Yeah, but look at that. I've seen this actually.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that. And that. Okay, so.
And they have all kinds of videos here, so I think you'll find it very interesting.
Yeah, so you go to, I'm going to lead you to that, Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Okay, that's the name of the site. Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
And the article is so you don't believe in chemtrails.
It doesn't say .com or nothing. It just says that. You know, it might be .com. I don't know. But it just says Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Okay, so check that out. And chemtrails. Boy. So
the pictures are.
It's really,
great.
You should take a look at them. You'll identify what chemtrails are.
We should go to a little music break, Leo.
It's fast. Yeah, let's go to a quick break and we'll be back in a few minutes.
For your listening pleasure, we have.
For your listening pleasure, we have Burnt Rubber Blues. Maybe.
Yeah, if it comes on. audio we're going to play.
But this article is on
full engagement in Agenda 21.
Yeah. Hang on 1 second. This will help. Here we go. Okay. European Commission announces full engagement in Agenda 21. On February 27th, the European Commission published a document of court announcing it will take on itself the lead role in global environmental governance over a unified policy framework in affecting aligning itself with Agenda 21. In a 30-page document entitled A Decent Life for All, the EC says it aspires to a leading role in the overarching framework toward global governance. The commissars profess to care about worldwide poverty, and environmental degradation, and other no-brainers, carefully handpicked by an elite class prepared to use any and every pretext behind which power is being centralized at the international level at the expense of sovereignty at the national one.
The world has undergone enormous change over recent years, the document reads, including major shifts in global economic and political balance, increased global trading, climate change, depletion of natural resources, technological change, and economic and financial crises, increased consumption, price volatility of food and energy consumption, population changes, migration, violence, armed conflict, and natural and man-made disasters and increased inequalities. Quite some parade of calamities the EU is willing to tackle. A lead role is what they work towards, the authors state, and the EU commissars are perfectly willing to debate their plans with the Europeans, only in name, Parliament. A few exceptions aside, the parliaments consist of nodding, dozing, and sometimes outright sleeping individuals who are there to approve the Commission's proposals and send their lunch bills to the European taxpayer. The EU needs to engage fully in the forthcoming international processes with coherent and coordinated inputs at the UN and other relevant fora. In this respect, the adoption of this communication should be followed by debate with the Council and Parliament during the spring of 2013, for the development of a common EU approach for the next stages of the ongoing processes. What a bunch of rhetoric.
I know.
So what is it that they mean? They're just going to control everything.
In stages, we immediately recognize the overarching framework as the merging of regional blocs, such as the EU with the United Nations and the Agenda 21. The Commission says to ensure a comprehensive follow-up to the Rio Number 20, and guide the EU position at the UN. Okay, open working groups. Okay, so in other words, you have to have a little bit of background into the Agenda 21, which is what this article really goes into it in detail. But what you got to know is that you're getting ready to be screwed, folks, and they're working on it real hard. And you can go to explosivereports.com and you can get the whole thing there. European Commission announces full engagement in Agenda 21. So, you know, be on the path. This is what this Gun Control Act is all about. This is what everything is about.
I was really, really
happy to hear the Senate told Feinstein to take a hike. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't approve her bill.
For gun control?
Yeah. They only accepted it as an amendment.
Let's go back up to Obama.
Yeah, I wanted to do that. He talks in this one
about
FEMA camps. Yeah. Obama explains the FEMA camps.
This is about 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
So
regarding his
prolonged
detention, right, for American citizens.
But we begin tonight with a tale of two speeches, both from the same man, both from President Obama. One speech that could have been billed as a ballad to the Constitution, a proclamation of American values, a repudiation of the lawless behavior of the last presidential administration, and another speech announcing a radical new claim of presidential power that is not afforded by the Constitution and that has never been attempted in American history, even by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Remarkably, President Obama today made both of those speeches simultaneously. Standing inside the National Archives in front of the actual original Constitution, President Obama delivered a blistering critique of the Bush administration, in which he called their actions and their legacy literally a mess.
Our government made a series of hasty decisions. Poorly planned, haphazard approach. Too often, we set those principles aside as luxuries that we could no longer afford. Our government made decisions based on fear rather than foresight. The decisions that were made over the last 8 years established an ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable.
An ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable. Ouch. Then, moments later, he announced his own ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism. President Obama today proposed something new, something called prolonged detention. Doesn't sound that bad, right? Prolonged detention. Did you ever see the movie Minority Report? It was based on a Philip K. Dick short story. It came out in 2002. It starred Tom Cruise, remember? He played a police officer in something called the Department of Pre-Crime. Pre-crime is where people are arrested and incarcerated to prevent crimes that they have not yet committed.
Mr. Marks, by mandate of the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division, I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubinos. Take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours, 4 minutes.
No, I didn't do anything.
You didn't do anything, but you're gonna. Future murder. Creepy, right? Putting somebody in jail, not for what they've done, but for what you're very sure they're going to do?
There may be a number of people who cannot be prosecuted for past crimes. In some cases, because evidence may be tainted. But who nonetheless pose a threat to the security of the United States.
We're not prosecuting them for past crimes, but we need to keep them in prison because of our expectation of their future crimes.
Al-Qaeda terrorists and their affiliates are at war with the United States, and those that we capture, like other prisoners of war, must be prevented from attacking us again.
Prevented. We will incarcerate people preventively. Preventive incarceration. Indefinite detention without trial. That's what this is. That's what President Obama proposed today, if you strip away the euphemisms. One civil liberties advocate told the New York Times today, quote, "We've known this was on the horizon for many years, but we were able to hold it off with George Bush. The idea that we might find ourselves fighting with the Obama administration over these powers is really stunning." And it is stunning, particularly to hear President Obama claim the power to keep people in prison indefinitely with no charges against them, no conviction, no sentence, just imprisonment. It's particularly stunning to hear him make that claim in the middle of a speech that was all about the rule of law.
But we must do so with an abiding confidence in the rule of law. Our government was defending positions that undermine the rule of law to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law.
How can a president speak the kind of poetry that President Obama does about the rule of law and call for the power to indefinitely, preventively imprison people because they might commit crimes in the future? How can those two things coexist in the same man, even in the same speech? Well, that brings us to the self-consciously awkward, embarrassing part of this speech today. After condemning the Bush administration for what he called their ad hoc legal strategy, for trying to make things seem legal that patently weren't, this is what President Obama proposed.
My administration has begun to reshape the standards that apply to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law. We must have clear, defensible, and lawful standards for those who fall into this category. We must have a thorough process of periodic review so that any prolonged detention is carefully evaluated and justified. Our goal is to construct a legitimate legal framework for the remaining Guantanamo detainees that cannot be transferred. Our goal is not to avoid a legitimate legal framework. In our constitutional system, prolonged detention should not be the decision of any one man. if and when we determine that the United States must hold individuals to keep them from carrying out an act of war, we will do so within a system that involves judicial and congressional oversight. And so going forward, my administration will work with Congress to develop an appropriate legal regime so that our efforts are consistent with our values and our Constitution.
You'll construct a legal regime to make indefinite detention legal. You will, what does he say? Develop an appropriate legal regime so you can construct a whole new system outside the courts, even outside the military commissions, so that you can indefinitely imprison people without charges. And you'll build that system from scratch. What's that somebody said about ad hoc legal strategies? Just for context here, in the United Kingdom, where there isn't even a Bill of Rights, there's been a major debate about whether people can be held in preventive detention. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair wanted 3 months to be the outer limit for how long anyone could be held. There was a big political fight about it. Parliament ended up limiting that power to 28 days. 28 days is still the longest period of preventive detention that's allowed under law in any comparable democracy anywhere in the world. How long would President Obama's proposed preventive indefinite detention last? Well, he's not saying yet, but here's how he defines the threat that he says makes indefinite detention necessary.
Right now in distant training camps and in crowded cities, there are people plotting to take American lives. That will be the case a year from now, 5 years from now, and in all probability, 10 years from now.
10 years from now? So you could get arrested today and locked up without a trial, without being convicted, without being sentenced for, say, 10 years until the threat of your future criminal behavior passes. Prolonged detention, he's calling it. This is a beautiful speech from President Obama today with patriotic, moving, even poetic language about the rule of law and the Constitution, and one of the most radical proposals for defying the Constitution that we have ever heard made to the American people.
That's so true.
So scary.
So true. You can see that on FireDogLake.com.
Rachel Maddow did a good job explaining that.
Yeah. Well, just so you know, there's a little picture here. It says, "Hi, I'm Michael Taylor, former vice president for Monsanto. We poison everything that you consume." And another picture of him says, "Hi, I'm Michael Taylor, deputy commissioner of the FDA. I'll protect you from assholes like myself."
Hard to do.
That says it all. Gotta protect himself. Protect the country from assholes like him. Yeah, thank you. I don't like Obama anymore. I don't. Never really did. I was just really scared to death of Romney. But you know, now I really don't like the guy at all. You?
No.
Thank you.
I didn't like him when he stood before Congress and said there were no voting irregularities.
Oh, that was before he became president.
That's right. And I was disgusted. He didn't even defend his own people. He was just a sellout. And he was just a sellout to bankers and everybody else.
Yeah, pretty sick. Pretty sick.
He's a fascist president, just like Bush was. The corporations tell him to jump, he says how high. In his case, the bankers tell him to jump, and he says how high.
Yeah.
Of course, he's got your money in his pocket.
Yeah.
And to lighten his jump, he gives them money.
Uh-huh. There is a great guy. Great, great guy. You know. I wanted to, sorry, folks, it's so damn slow. I really kind of enjoyed this article. I don't know. This one about welcoming Barack Obama into Palestine.
Uh-huh.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Where they're driving over his picture.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, thought that pretty much sized it up for how much there are these loans there. Well, anyway, it's a kind of a quickie article, but it just so you know, Palestinians have held a demonstration in the occupied West Bank against the upcoming visit of U.S. President Barack Obama and destroyed a banner bearing his image. On Monday, they trampled on the banner, drove over it with the cars, and then burned it in the West Bank city of Bethlehem. On March 15th, Palestinians in Ramallah, which hosts the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, vandalized posters showing Obama. And Obama is scheduled to arrive in Israel tomorrow, which on Wednesday, is likely to visit the occupied West Bank the following day. After Palestinians accused the U.S. president of following the path of his predecessors and unfairly favoring the Israeli regime, they accused Obama of not doing enough to stop Israel's illegal settlement activities, as well as the arbitrary arrest of Palestinians by Israeli troops. In December 2012, Israeli officials said they would not go ahead with the plans to build several thousand more settler units on Palestinian territory, despite the opposition of the United States and the international community. So they kept going instead. The presence and continued expansion of the Israeli settlements in occupied Palestine have created a major obstacle for the efforts to establish peace in the Middle East. More than 500,000 Israelis live in over 120 illegal settlements built since Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and the East al-Quds in 1967. The UN and most countries regard the Israeli settlements as illegal because the territories were captured by Israel in a war in 1967 and are hence subject to the Geneva Conventions, which forbid construction on occupied lands. So there, folks. That's the way it is in Palestine. Mr. Big Obi, or Juan Kenobi, Obi-Wan Kenobi, is not very well loved there. No. Okay. I want to, there was something here I wanted to say Guard of Resistance was pretty good. This one more.
Okay. We just have a few more minutes.
Yeah. There was something pretty good in here that I wanted to play. This Zionism going through death throes. I really kind of got felt optimistic about this a little bit more than. Poor Richard's blog still out here or something. Else.
It says Zionism is going through death throes by senior editor.
Yeah, but I can't get the article up.
Well, just give it a minute.
It keeps jumping.
Zionism and dead as it goes through its death throes. Much is revealed of its nature. President Obama is preparing for his upcoming trip to Israel. He represents the most powerful military force in history of the world. He also represents a nation bankrupt, flat broke, busted, a nation sick of war, and in a nation of skeptics.
In the meantime, news will report that America is ready and willing to shed its last drop of blood to defend Israel, and that America stands ready to launch shock and awe attacks at any moment on Iran, despite continuing fruitful diplomatic negotiations. But Israel no longer has the love and trust of the American people, including and especially American Jews. And Netanyahu's government no longer has the love and trust of the Israeli people, as the recent election has shown. And thus, anyone seeking a shred of reality from the pop culture media of the PSYOPs-ridden blogosphere will have to develop their between-the-lines reading skills. The name is already on. The game is already on. Where is that? A little over a week ago, the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and their Israeli National News all described the meets between Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak and new American Secretary Chuck Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel as warm and productive. And the American media, prior to the meeting, had planted false stories about the close friendship between Barak and Hagel. The truth is, Hagel and Barak are and have been anyone but friends. A top U.S. defense official who worked closely with Barak said this of him: "Gordy is one of the dumbest SOBs I've ever met." Okay, he's talking about Gordy. Who's Gordy?
Mm-hmm.
Barak so anti-charismatic that his own dog wouldn't follow him even if he hung a pork chop around his neck. Who the hell is this guy? Who is Gordy?
I don't know.
Gordy, I don't know. He's not talking about Netanyahu or... not only were stories about the warm and lasting friendship between Hagel and Barak a wild fabrication, the results of their meetings were as well. Both the American and Israeli papers, all owned by the same clique, mischaracterized...
Are they owned by the Hearst paper?
No. Defense recited as though it were a policy discussion involving foreign ministers and heads of state. Mm-hmm. America agreed to invade Iran, even if it means every last drop of blood for every goyim American. Secretary Hagel saw the same meeting thusly: "Why is this idiot in my office?" Netanyahu lost election. And a question ago, the Israeli press report an article from the obscure World Tribune describing upcoming American cutbacks and demand by President Obama that Israel abandon the occupied territories in accordance with the United Nations resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look at this interval, we see Netanyahu staging a threat in order to garner support from extremist parties who, out of desperation, will help extend his rule through a marriage, not just between different species, but different phylum as well. Thus, we finally glimpse the monstrosity that weeks of negotiation have assembled, a true Frankensteinian regime.
Oh.
And today, Netanyahu finally put together his coalition government weeks late, more than unstable and largely dominated by settler elements, as we see from Roitov and Veterans Today. He says that Netanyahu will be the next prime minister, but he lost the election in coalition negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
The settlers became the principal winners, even if his party shows restraint and doesn't carry out a putsch against him. This is probably the last government to be led by Bibi. He should never have chosen a nickname that means also my sewage.
Great.
It became a self-fulfilling Pygmalion prophecy. That's fine. It goes on, I bomb and so on, but we're out of time. Yep. But I'm going to, history will erase Zionism from the sands of time. And that is exactly what the king of Iran, their president of Iran, said.
Ahmadinejad,
yeah. Mm-hmm. History will erase Zionism from
the sands of time.
He didn't say we'll blow them up from the face of the earth. He said history will erase them.
Well, because their agenda is bad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're goners.
So on that note,
we want to thank you for joining us. Yeah. And
thanks for being with us. And tune in tomorrow and talk with us.
Please do. And
talking with you. We'll be speaking about union issues for the first part of the show. The second part of the show, we'll catch up on political issues.
Yeah.
Of a different nature.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us. And
good night, folks.
Have a wonderful day.
Not much left to it.
Let me see if I can find my 30-second music here.
It's not playing?
That's right. All right, good night, everyone.
Sorry, folks, we couldn't play any music.
Yeah, good night, everyone.